We left off, I guess we're on page 3 of your notes, huh? Of the new sweeping generalization. We're going through some of the logical fallacies. In this fallacy, you apply a general rule to a specific instance. For example, you get what you pay for. That's a general rule. It's true, right? Generally, what you pay for, you get. Therefore, it's better to spend $200 on that T-shirt at the boutique shop than to buy the same one at Marshall's for $29. Marshall's is a place in the U.S. that they go to high-end stores, and they have like a slight factory defect. Sometimes you can notice it, most time you can't even notice it. And so that you can get high-end designer clothes at a much reduced price. So as opposed to a boutique shop, which is going to buy the high end. So that's a sweeping generalization. You get what you pay for. That's generally true, but it doesn't apply in every situation. So you make a claim that's larger than the evidence suggests. Related to that is a hasty generalization. In this fallacy, the reverse of the preceding one, you apply a specific rule to a general situation without proper evidence. For example, my father smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day and lived to be 85. Therefore, smoking can't really be that bad for you. Ever heard anyone use that one? Yeah. Of course, the obvious question is, how long would you have lived if you hadn't smoked? 105, maybe. False cause. In this fallacy, you assert that because two events occur together, they must be causally related. But correlation is not causality. It's a fallacy because it ignores other factors that may be the cause of the event. So, for example, literacy rates have steadily declined since the advent of television. Clearly, television viewing impedes learning. So you have two events that happen at the same time. Literacy rates, the ability to read, has gone down as television rates have gone up. Just because those two factors happen at the same time doesn't mean that one caused the other. But by putting them together, you say, see, clearly television impedes learning. Well, it might, but you can't prove it from that statistic. Now, I used to be in Maranatha. Do we have any other ex-Maranatha people? No. One. Yeah, right. One. Okay, so this was a common fallacy in Maranatha. Here's what we would do. If someone left the church, you know about Maranatha though, right? You got an idea? Okay. So if someone left the church, which like that's a cardinal sin, right? You don't do that. Someone left the church and then something bad happened to them. You know where I'm going, don't you? It was obviously that bad thing happened because they broke covenant relationship. This is a fallacious idea. The fact that the bad thing happened around the same time they left, there's no logical correlation between the two. Because, of course, people who stayed in the fellowship, they had bad things happen to them too. Because, you know, if you live for any length of time, bad stuff's going to happen, right? Yeah? That's part of our theology, isn't it? Already, not yet, so it's a fallen world. But nobody bothered to apply the principle then. You see? Someone leave, bad thing happened. Oh, clearly, that's a result of their breaking covenant, God's judgment upon them. But what about the people who stayed in the fellowship and the bad thing happened? Was that God's judgment on them for staying in Maranatha? Now, nobody ever brought that one up. So that's false cause. You see, because two things happen around the same time, we assume that one caused the other. That's fallacious logic. The next one is the no true Scotsman. And I don't have a whole lot of application for you, but I just like the name of it. So I thought it'd be fun to talk about it. I'm a Scotsman, so I appreciated this. In this fallacy, a belief is rendered unfalsifiable by shifting the goalpost so that it won't apply to a supposedly true example. And it gets the name from this. So one person asserts, no Scotsman puts sugar on his porridge. Now, you know what porridge is? Yeah, so that's... Huh? Okay, champurrado, yeah. Whatever, yeah. Yeah, we don't have that. We don't have that. So Scots love porridge. It's a breakfast. It's made out of a... There are very different kinds, you know. Made out of wheat or corn or various different kinds. But then it's a hot cereal, and you could put various different toppings on it. So no Scotsman puts sugar on his porridge. The other person might say, but my Uncle Angus puts sugar on his porridge. Then you would come back, but no true Scotsman puts sugar on his porridge. No true Scotsman. So we use this sometimes. So a Christian does something really, or a person with a public name or as being a Christian does something really bad. And he says, see, Christians do that. Well, no true Christian would do that. Yeah. But the reality is obviously true Christians do it. I like the no true Scotsman idea. The red herring. Now, this is an interesting one, the red herring. In this fallacy, you introduce irrelevant material to the issue being discussed so that everyone's attention is diverted away from the points made. It gets a name from hounds that were trained for the fox hunt in England by dragging red herrings across the path the fox had taken. The dogs had to ignore the fish order to stay on track for the real quarry. So you've probably seen movies where they have the fox hunt, right? Where they let the fox out and all these hounds, like beagles, they go chasing, and people on the horses, they try to chase the fox. So to train foxes, or to train hounds to follow the scent, they would let out a fox, or they'd have a fox scent along a path, and then along that path, they would drag herring, red herring, which, have you eaten herring? Do you have that here? It's a fish, but it's a fish with a very powerful aroma. So they drag the fish across that path. And the hounds, they'd be following the fox scent, but then when they would get to the red herrings, they'd go off course to follow that. And so they began disciplining the hounds not to follow all the other scents and to keep that one scent, even though there were other conflicting scents. So the term a red herring is often used in murder mystery writings or dramas or various things. If you like any particular show, I've started watching a show called Elementary. I don't know if you get it here, but it's like a modern-day Sherlock Holmes. And so there's a crime that's committed, and there's several suspects, and they always, one suspect looks like he's the most likely to have done it. That's called a red herring. The author introduces that to get you off the scent of what the real killer is. So this is used in when you're presenting a case. Someone presents a case, and instead of actually responding to that case, you throw sort of a wrench into it that sends the argument off into a completely different direction. And so you never actually deal with the thing that the person is presenting. Now, husbands are real good with this one. Okay? So the wife is confronting you, and she has a good argument about something that you've done that's wrong that needs to change. Right? So you can throw in a red herring. Now, there are various different ways you can do this, of course. You can mention something similar that she's done. Yeah? Anybody ever done that one? Yeah? Or you can bring up, maybe right in the middle of it, something that you know that she's really worried or concerned about that might distract her. Like, honey, this is really important what you're saying, but first, remember the kids are coming next week, and I'm not sure where we're going to put them. Have we thought about, I don't know where all the kids, where are we going to put them? Of course, my wife, that's all she would, she'd go down that argument, you know, and we'd spend the rest of the day, and then hopefully we'd never get back to the real issue. So that's the red herring, to try to get them off the scent of where they're going. Slippery slope. In this fallacy, you state that if A happens, then Z will eventually happen. Therefore, A should not happen. No proof is made that the lawful events are caused by the first event. For example, we must stop government bans on pornography. Once they ban one form of literature, they will soon be burning all the books. That's the slippery slope, you see. It's the idea that if you do this, it will inevitably lead to that. Now, sometimes we do this in counseling. Sometimes we even do it in preaching. Someone is, you know, maybe they sin. They look at something they shouldn't look at. Look at an internet site or something. And so we warn them that this could lead to adultery and your wife leaving you. Well, that's a slippery slope argument, because especially if it's presented like it's inevitable that once you start down this path, you will automatically end here. Now, the Bible definitely makes a correlation. There is in the Bible, there are steps that sin progresses along, okay? And that's valid. So certainly it is possible that if a person starts just one time, looks at an internet site, it is possible that there could be another time and it could lead to other things and ultimately could lead down there. Slippery slope, though, is when you assume that the first part of the chain inevitably and automatically leads to the end of the chain, skipping all the steps in between. And a lot of that times that's done out of fear. You know, that's a fear motivation. If you do that, next thing you know, you'll be doing this. Sometimes we do that when we raise our children. You know, it's a little manipulative technique. And then especially if you incorporate it with the other fallacy of anecdotal evidence, and then you bring a case. I know one guy, one time he looked, and then the next thing you know, he was divorcing his wife, and now he's a practicing whatever that can be. So this is a fallacy. Now, it's not a fallacy if you show the logical connection that one thing could have a potential consequence and lead to another consequence and another consequence. I'll give you a couple negative examples. I on my way here to Manila, I stopped off at our church in Seattle. And the residence that I stayed at while I was there, right across the street, it's a very common sight in Seattle, was a legal marijuana shop. So I could have walked across the street and purchased legally marijuana and gone back to my residence and smoked it. California, just since I left on my trip, has just legalized marijuana. one state after another, and it looks like it's inevitable. It's going to spread throughout the United States. The primary argument that was used for years to stop the legalization of marijuana, it was the slippery slope argument. If you legalize marijuana, it leads to hard drugs, heroin, etc. That was the primary argument. We don't want to legalize Maranatha. Yeah, that should never have been legalized. We don't want to legalize marijuana because that will lead to, if that's the slippery slope, you see. You open up marijuana shops, the next thing you know, there'll be heroin addicts all over the place. The reality is there has been no proven scientific clinical evidence that marijuana smoking leads to those other kinds of drugs. So that slippery slope argument was eventually, by the marijuana lobby, was proven to be invalid, and they had no other argument left. And so once that argument was debunked, now marijuana is being legalized all over the place. Another example, I watched recently a number of specials about, there was one on the 50s, 60s, 70s, and the 80s in America. And so we were working through each one of my wife and I, we watched them. And one of the big events throughout my lifetime, starting in the 60s, went through the 70s, and I think even into the 80s, probably the worst geopolitical mistake that the Americans have ever made in our history, which is the war in Vietnam. And the war in Vietnam, getting involved in that conflict, it was an unwinnable war. It was impossible. And a lot of the generals and the military advisors said in the beginning, you cannot win this war. It's impossible to win it. It's just not a winnable war. And warned them against it. But the slippery slope argument was used. It was the idea that if one nation falls to communism, it'll start a domino effect, and then the entire Asia will become communist. And so this slippery slope often has an element of fear. We don't want the whole world to become communist, right? Well, we better go fight the communists in Vietnam, because if we yield and we give up Vietnam, then the next thing you know, nation after nation after nation will fall. That was the slippery slope argument, and it proved to put us into a situation that we could never, ever get out of. So that makes sense to you, slippery slope? The next is the straw man. Have you heard of this one? The straw man. In this fallacy, you ignore a person's actual position and substitute a distorted or misrepresented version so that it can be attacked more easily. When you knock down that position, you conclude that the original position has been demolished. It's a fallacy because it fails to deal with the actual arguments that have been made. So this is a very common one, straw man. Straw man is when you misrepresent the viewpoint of the person or the doctrine or the idea that you're discounting. You misrepresent it. And then you attack that misrepresented version. And of course, it's always easier to attack because it's not the actual version. It's a distorted version. And so then when you attack that, and then you see, I've proven to you that that viewpoint is wrong. It fails to deal with the actual arguments that have been made. You know you've done a straw man if somebody who believes in, they hold the position that you've attacked, and they hear you speak, and they say, you did not accurately represent us. That's not what we believe. Then you built up a straw man. When we attack other viewpoints, Lourdes, do we have enough copies of that exercise that we did yesterday? Okay, well, hang on. I think we may use those. Wonderful. If you could just do a quick count, but you probably have already, because we got a few extras, you know. If there are 14, I'll just take them. Just bring them to me, yeah, because I don't want to do it yet. I'm going to give you an actual assignment here. Okay? Straw man, cherry picking. Cherry picking. In this fallacy, also called the fallacy of incomplete evidence, this fallacy is choosing to make selective choices among competing evidence to emphasize those results that support a given position while ignoring or dismissing any findings that do not support it. The stronger the withheld evidence, the more fallacious the argument. Example, nearly all resumes. You ever made a resume? Essentially, in resumes, we only put the positive information that we want to present. If maybe one particular job, we didn't work there very long, or we got let go, we may not put that evidence in. So cherry picking is when you're selective about your evidence. Now, maybe Sam, was it you earlier asked about the use of statistics? Yeah, statistics are often used this way. They're used to present one particular side. So statistics have shown that such and such. But there were other studies also that had different or varying conclusions. You fail to mention that and only mention that one particular statistic. So statistics can be used, certainly, but they're often used fallaciously. And the last one, which doesn't have a whole lot of use for us, but I just love the name of it. So it's called the Texas Sharpshooter. In this fallacy, a random data pattern is used to prove a point. The term comes from a joke about a Texan who gets drunk and shoots up his barn. Then he paints a bullseye around the largest cluster of bullet holes. This fallacy ignores data not in the cluster and focuses on data that is. Clusters do not prove causal relationship. So you see the picture? So this is a Texan. All Texans have guns. And apparently all Texans get drunk. So, and all Texans have barns, too, right? These are sweeping generalizations. Logical fallacy. And so this Texan, he gets drunk, and he gets out his gun, and he just starts shooting up his barn. Now, the next day, when he's sober or semi-sober, he looks, and random sampling, right? It's a random sampling. Just the nature of randomness is that some of the bullets are going to be clustered, and then there's going to be large distances between others. So there's going to be a random clustering. So he gets his red paint, and he paints a bullseye where most of those bullet holes are. And now it looks like he's quite the sharpshooter. See? He shot right in the middle of that target, but he actually didn't. So that's a fallacy when random data, you know, and there's always going to be clusters in data. It doesn't prove causality, but that cluster is used to prove your point when it doesn't actually prove your point at all. Any questions, thoughts about these? So I think we'll just do a little experiment here. I'm going to, here's an article. Now, let me preface it. This is an article I cut out of the Nashville newspaper about 15 years ago. It was in the Christian section. It's written by a Baptist man, obviously a believer, and he's opposed to capital punishment, and he's attacking Christians who use the Bible to defend capital punishment. Okay? And so this is a pretty common debate in our country. I don't know if this is a debate here, but it's a big debate in our country. Generally, conservative evangelical Christians support the death penalty from biblical evidence. And generally, liberal individuals, whether Christians or not, are opposed to the death penalty. And so he writes his article. We're going to read it together. And then using this list, I want you to see how many of these logical fallacies, because it's really chock full. He's got a lot of fallacies in there. Okay? I'll pass it out, and then I'll read it, and we'll follow along, and we'll see. As I'm reading, you can make comments where you think maybe we've seen one of those fallacies. Okay, everybody have one? Yeah? No. Coming. Good. Please stop using the scriptures as rationale for capital punishment. Please don't use the Bible to justify the death penalty. Texts from the Old Testament may be used to support the death penalty. Of course, the Hebrew society was a theocracy and not a democracy. While many of us may want to be the American theo, God, we have not been given that right or responsibility. Moreover, most theo pretenders are very selective about what they apply from that era. At least none of them has spoken publicly in favor of the death penalty for Sabbath breaking or parent cursing, two of the punishable offenses listed in the Old Testament. Nevertheless, if we read the Old Testament literally to justify the American death penalty, then let's be consistent. Let's practice literally the Old Testament's form of death penalty. Public stoning was the Old Testament's method. People gathered, picked up stones, and threw them at the violator until he or she was battered to death. If we practice the Old Testament death penalty, then the governor, preachers, lawyers, reporters, the victim's family, and others will cast stones at the guilty party until death. No more lethal injection, no more electrocution. Who wants to pick up the first stone? Making the case on the death penalty from the New Testament is more problematic. Death penalty advocates always cite Romans 13, where the Apostle Paul wrote about God-appointed governing authorities who do not bear the sword in vain, but who execute the wrath of God on wrongdoers. They argue the sword means the state has the right to execute. Here's the problem with this literal reading. The word for sword does not mean a double-edged, three-foot fighting weapon. It really means a police dagger, hardly the weapon for execution. Furthermore, the Roman method of death penalty was not decapitation, the implication one could draw from the use of a sword. The Roman method was crucifixion, the very form of Jesus' death penalty. Surely death penalty advocates who point to the New Testament to justify their position presumably do not want to reinstitution of crucifixion. Christianity has a rich heritage of using the Bible to support moral attitudes and practices. Some of our heritage is praiseworthy, other parts of it are shameful. We frequently say, the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it. The honest truth is that many of our moral arguments make a different sequence. I believe it, the Bible supports me, that settles it. We find a Bible verse to back up our predetermined moral position. When we draw a straight and literal line from the Bible to 21st century public policy, we misuse God's divine treasure chest. The Bible is not a literal blueprint for the American justice system. It's a moral compass that gives us direction. Make the case for the death penalty with legal arguments, moral reasoning, and sociological studies. But please don't use the Bible to bypass the tough work of thinking deeply about how we apply biblical principles and practices to gritty contemporary issues. All right. What do you think? Anybody see any? I'll tell you what some of them are and see if you can find them. He uses straw man, ad hominem, red herring, slippery slope, and cherry picking. All those are in there. At least some of them multiple times. Can you see any? Yes, sir. Can you put it on the microphone? Yeah. Make sure it's on.
Thank you. Thank you. The first word I got from the statement, the second sentence, CU presenters are very selective about what they apply for that from that era. Could this be related to cherry picking? There is a selectivity of what they want to present only.
No, no. What I'm wanting, what the assignment is that we're looking for this person's fallacious use, uh-huh. Right? So,
could it still be related to it, the selective part that he mentioned here? Moreover, the most few presenters are very selective.
Yeah. I don't think it's actually true.
Okay.
Actually, that section right there is more ad hominem. Yeah. See, because he uses this negative term. He calls them a theo pretender. In other words, people who are reasoning from the Bible to defend capital punishment, he calls them people who are trying to play God. That's attacking the person rather than the argument. So that's the ad hominem. Instead of actually examining the evidence, he just tacks them, saying they're just theo pretenders, pretending to play God, and they have no right to do that. That's ad hominem. Okay, keep going. Yes, sir. What you got there?
He said that at least none of them has
Tell
spoken.
Tell me the paragraph. Where are we?
Second paragraph.
Text
second sentence. At least none of them has spoken publicly in favor of the death penalty for Sabbath breaking
yeah.
or parent cursing.
Yeah.
I think it's diverting the I think it's the
Could
red
be.
Herring. Could
yeah.
be.
Yeah. It's definitely a logical fallacy. Mm. I've got it listed as a straw man.
Mm.
Okay. And the reason why is because it says at least none of them have spoken publicly in favor of the death penalty for Sabbath breaking or parent cursing. Now, what you do is the people who are presenting an argument for the biblical use of capital punishment recognize that we live in America in a democracy, not a theocracy. So they are not trying to suggest that all of the violations under the theocracy that were for capital punishment are applicable in our country. So he deliberately sets up this straw man that says what those people, the capital punishment defenders are saying is, what about Sabbath breaking? We're going to kill you. Parent cursing. And, of course, that's easy to attack. Everybody would read that and say, well, we don't want that. But none of the people who are presenting the arguments for the biblical case for death penalty are saying that. He creates this straw man that doesn't really represent the arguments, and then he attacks it. And, of course, you know, it's easy to attack because that looks stupid if that's really is their argument. So, yeah, good. Good, yeah. What do we got, Gio?
The one that says, furthermore, or the Roman method of death penalty.
Furthermore, yeah, good. Okay.
It's not decapitation, the implication. I think it's more of a red herring.
Okay. Why do you think that?
Well, the topic is about the death penalty, not the method of, or that's what they're really trying to, not really the specific type of how it's done, but the topic is really, is it... it's about the capital punishment, not
yeah.
about the...
Yeah, great. Yeah, great. I think you could be right. I listed it as cherry-picking, but you're making a pretty good point, too. The reason why I call it cherry-picking is he says the Roman method of death penalty was not decapitation, it was crucifixion. Well, he's not given all the evidence. He's left out. I don't know if deliberately or he just didn't do his homework. The Roman method of death penalty actually was both, but it depended if you were a Roman citizen or not. So the reason why Peter was crucified, and he was actually crucified upside down, is that he was not a Roman citizen. The reason why Paul, who was a Roman citizen, was decapitated is because that was a more humane, it was a quicker death. Crucifixion is a painful death, right? Decapitation is an instant death. And so by cherry picking, by leaving out some evidence, he is presenting a fallacious argument. And he goes on to add, you know, he makes this distinction that there were two kinds of Roman swords. One was the big 3-foot one. The one was actually it's a little bit more than a dagger. But the purpose of a dagger or a much, you know, it's not one of those. It's not a dagger, but it's, you know, it's about that big. The purpose is still to kill people, right? So the sword metaphor that Paul uses still refers to the ability to actually take a life. Regardless of what kind of sword, you can be killed with a pocket knife, right? So that's another fallacious argument. Yeah, you got another one. We're on a roll now. See, what I like here is when you start thinking this way, now you start becoming attuned to the reading, and you're reading it closer. Things that maybe you skipped over in the past, you're reading a little bit closer. Yeah, go ahead. Give me another one.
I think when it says here that Christianity has a rich heritage of using the Bible to support moral attitudes and practices, I think it's in the ad hominem.
Okay.
Because he attacks the Christians.
Yeah. I think that's right, yeah. And he actually mocks these people who are using the Bible to defend capital punishment.
Yes,
he mocks them. So that's good. Yeah, I didn't catch that, but you're right. That's ad hominem. Yes, sir.
Third paragraph.
Okay.
Public stoning was the Old Testament's method.
Yeah.
People gathered, pick up stones, and threw them at the violator until he or she was battered to death. If we practice the Old Testament death penalty, then the governor, preachers, lawyers, reporters, the victim's family, and others will cast stones at the guilty party until death. No more lethal injection, no more electrocution.
Yeah.
Sweeping generalization.
Tell me how you see that.
He was comparing the Old Testament way of death penalty. So he was trying to generalize how it is going to happen in this generation, that we would also no longer use a lethal injection or electrocution.
Okay.
Just generalize.
Okay.
Everybody should also be stoned to death.
All right. It's a possibility. I had it down for, I think when he says, who wants to pick up the first stone, I think this is slippery slope. Slippery slope, you see. We start down this road of obeying the Bible, and the next thing you know, we'll be actually the ones picking up stones and throwing them at people and killing them. So if you start this way, it looks like here's where, if you start trying to actually apply the Bible, you start that way, and here's where it's going to end. We're all going to be picking up stones to try to kill each other. I think that's slippery slope. I also think that that section, I just lost it here. I think there's some straw man at work here. So nobody who's advocating the death penalty is advocating this method. That's not their argument. So someone who was representing the biblical view of death penalty would say, you did not represent me properly. That's not what our writing is about. That's not what we're talking about. We're not suggesting that. We're suggesting that that was a particular method for a particular era, but it's not the method that we're suggesting now. So he misrepresents, creates this straw man, puts fear in people, and easily attacks it. Yes.
Pastor Paul, I was just thinking with what I read a while ago about saying that Christianity has a rich heritage, using the Bible to support moral attributes and practices. Could it be categorized as hasty generalization, wherein we speak of all Christians doing that while others do that?
Yeah, could be. Yeah. Okay. I hadn't thought of that. Great. You're finding ones I didn't find. Adrian.
The eighth paragraph, we frequently say, the Bible says it, I believe it, that tells us, the honest truth is that many of our moral arguments take a different sequence. I believe it, the Bible supports me, that settles this. It's Strowman. Strowman fallacy. He misrepresent what they said, and he said it in a different way.
Yeah. I think it's a fallacy, and maybe you could make a point. But I thought it was more ad hominem because it's attacking the person as opposed to attacking their position. But that's just my thought. Anything else? I had a red herring. So let's see. My red herring is... I thought when he said, nevertheless, 1, 2, 3. Nevertheless, if we read the Old Testament... Literally, to justify the American death penalty, let's literally practice. I think that's a red herring to get us off of the point. What we're talking about is, does the Bible teach us about the validity of the death penalty? But now what we've done is we've dragged a scent, and let's talk about the methodology. Because we're not even talking about methodology here. We're just talking about, does the Bible defend capital punishment? And then let's just get us off track by talking about, well, the form and the method. And certainly we don't want to use the Bible method. One last thought, and I don't know where this fits, or it doesn't fit into the one that I listed, but it's called the fallacy of contradiction. And it's in the very last paragraph, the fallacy of contradiction. The fallacy of contradiction is when a statement is made that is inconsistent with itself, to the point that it refutes itself. So watch what he says. Please don't use the Bible to bypass the tough work of thinking deeply about how we apply biblical principles. Do you see the contradiction? Don't use the Bible to bypass how we think about biblical principles. Well, where do we get biblical principles from? So don't use the Bible to think about biblical principles. That's a complete contradiction. These are biblical principles, right? Where would you get biblical principles from? The Bible. So don't use the Bible to use the Bible. Fallacy of contradiction. The statement completely is inconsistent and contradicts itself to the point it's just ludicrous. So that's the end of my assignment, end of critical thinking. And maybe we should find something else. What did we leave off last time that we want to finish? Did we completely finish systematic theology? Help me see where we are. I don't think we did. Did we finish it? Yes? Yeah. Okay, let me see if I can find it. Yeah, no, I got to find the actual document. So, yes, sir. Go ahead, good. Related to critical thinking. Yeah, good.
Yeah. I was just thinking, how do we address the mentality of people who they listen more, the people with titles or PhD or doctorate, they have their voice has more weight compared to a person who has no title. And for example, more people in their congregation are bombarded by info from television who have PhDs that doesn't, and their what they say is not biblical. How do we maneuver that kind of situation? How do we manage?
Do you have
that?
An example?
For example, here in the I think here in our country, talk show hosts are.
But do talk show hosts have PhDs?
Yes, like Boy Abunda, he has a PhD in I think in psychology, like that.
Oh yeah, right.
And his views are humanistic and definitely unbiblical. And for some people, because they have a title like that, they're more reliable or more knowledgeable in these issues of life. Yeah. And we have, and us, for me, I'm not, I don't have a PhD or any title. I'm only a pastor. So somehow their views or opinions has more weight in the mind of the unbelievers compared to what I say. Or they may think that pastors only know the Bible. That's the only thing that we hold on to.
Yeah. What do you normally do when this comes up?
Well, I go to logic and think, is it really, if that kind of reasoning livable, do we want to live in a world that, with that kind of philosophy? Yeah, like that.
Yeah, you want to comment?
Yeah. Normally when I was able to come across some people who are like that, and normally what I do is, if that person is talking about an area of his expertise, if he's talking about fashion, you go and believe him because that's what he's good at. But if he's talking about morality, you go to the person who is more credible to talk about morality.
Yeah. But I don't think Arthur's talking about morality here. So I see this case, and I think it's a valid one. So he's a PhD in psychology, and he's talking about human relations, right? And he's presenting these ideas, psychological ideas, but they're not from a biblical perspective, but they're from a humanistic perspective. And so the idea is he spent his life being trained in this. You haven't. He should have more weight in what he says than what you say. So how do you deal with that? Adrian's got a plan.
For example, that case, one is expert in psychology and you are not. And I'm thinking, I will ask the question, what is the source of that psychology PhD graduate? And do you agree with his source? Now, I have a source. Do you agree with my source? So it's up to you, who would you agree? For example, if he doesn't agree with the Bible, then there's no more to argue with that. But he agrees that the Bible is the final authority, then it's easier for me to say, then do you think that what the psychology graduate PhD says is consistent with the Word of God? So I think that's what I can do.
I think that's how I would go too. I think it brings up a bigger question to me, is that are we teaching people how to evaluate everything in life based on God's perspective? There's a general idea in religious circles is that the Bible is about spiritual matters, and it doesn't address other issues. And so if I need to know about how to pray or how we run our church, then you go to the Bible for that. But the Bible doesn't talk about psychology. It doesn't talk about science. It doesn't talk about all these other areas. So I have to refer to other experts in those areas. And I think you combat that by constantly reinforcing the idea that the Bible provides the principles for evaluating and understanding every area of human endeavor. There's no academic discipline that's separate from the Bible, or that the Bible it's not a science textbook, right? People will say that, but the Bible is not a book of psychology. No, the Bible doesn't tell us how to do psychology. Well, what the Bible teaches is the starting point, the proper starting point for all intellectual pursuits. It's the starting point for all intellectual pursuits. So if I want to study psychology, then the way that I should start is I should find out what are the biblical principles that underlie all of psychology. And now I should begin my pursuit of psychology, always asking the question, what are the biblical principles that apply in this situation? What does the Bible say about this? Because we believe that the Bible has something to say about all of life. It has something to say about all of life. So because a person has a PhD in psychology, it doesn't mean automatically that what he's going to tell us is going to be right. Because unless he started with biblical foundational ideas, then he's building on the wrong foundation. He's building on humanistic, he's building on pagan, sinful presupposition ideas that are opposed to the Bible. And we would be unwise to listen to him, no matter how many degrees he has or how much he studied, if his starting point in his reasoning, his source, isn't from the Bible. Arthur, you're giving me that look again, like... That's that same look I saw earlier. No, I want Arthur to talk to me first. I don't feel like I'm connecting with you. Like, you're thinking, but tell me what you're thinking.
I'm just thinking that maybe for us Christians, it's enough to say that the Bible is the source. It
yes.
Should be the source. But if we're talking with unbelievers,
yeah.
then for them, the PhD professor is more credible than me. Like that.
But I don't think we can get away from that. I mean, I wouldn't try to convince an unbeliever that I'm smarter in the area of psychology than a secular PhD in psychology. I wouldn't even want to start. I had the idea. I thought you were talking about church members who are listening to these people because they've got all these credentials and you don't, so they're listening to them. So I'm answering the question how I would answer it with a church member, a Bible believer. I want to eradicate this idea that somehow that there's parts of knowledge that are independent from God. And I want to convince them that all truth is God's truth and it all starts in the Bible. And in the Bible, we have the foundation not just for how to develop our spiritual life, but it covers, in principle, it covers every area of life. And so the proper psychology would be a psychology that starts with biblical ideas, like ideas about man created in the image of God. See, most psychology starts with the idea of man as an evolved ape. Okay? So when you start with that idea, then your presuppositions are going to lead you to all kinds of wrong ideas and practices. So the right psychology is a psychology that goes to the Bible, finds out what are the baseline presupposition principles that we can start building upon to create a biblical approach to psychology. Now, if you listen to a person like that, because people like that have some wisdom to offer, But you have to be aware that even though something he says sounds like it makes a lot of sense, it doesn't start from the Bible, and it will not lead you to positive biblical fruits. Now talk to me, Arthur. You're looking a little bit better. I like that countenance a little bit more, but keep going. Talk to me. Because I'm getting that look. No, pick that microphone up. Talk to me.
Right now, I'm still thinking.
Still thinking. Okay. When you're done thinking, you're going to pick up the microphone and talk.
I think what the Bible says that we cannot really argue with them, because the Bible says that without the Spirit of God, they cannot really understand the things of God.
Yeah.
Because of their hardened heart, sure. Even that they will know the truth, they will twist the truth.
Suppress it, yeah. Yeah. And so for an unbelieving person, you know, I wouldn't even try to engage in that argument. I would try to get them to talk to me about their relationship with God. And I would try, you know, that's what I care about. So what do you think, Arthur?
I have no more questions.
That's not true. Adrian.
I think it's the same way with, I don't know if I get it right, the nuclear physicist Stephen Hawking, about arguing, he is a PhD physicist, popular, and he's arguing about the Big Bang Theory versus there's no God. He has more credibility than all of us.
All of us
about physics, but still, we put the premium on the Word of God. Which reminds me also of, I remember, if you can remember, there is this, the modified Engel scale in the Making Disciples training, the four quadrants.
Yeah, love it.
For those people who are open, and the first quadrant who are open and knowledgeable, then you directly preach the gospel. For those people who are open but not knowledgeable, then you teach the gospel. For those who not open and not knowledgeable, then you build relationship. So it's not necessarily you win them in an argument, but get to know them, engage, establish, equip, empower. So you engage them. And then in the last group of people, those who know the truth but reject it, and there's a different approach to that. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach to different people. But I believe we've been equipped and we've been given the tools to how to engage different kinds of people.
Yeah,
in the ministry.
But I think I'm most concerned in this class about people in our own church. And that's why I went about answering that question. And I think there are a lot of people who, they have a compartmentalized view of the Bible and about life. So there's like two divisions. There's the secular world, secular life, and then there's the spiritual life. And the Bible has everything to say about our spiritual life. So, Pastor, I'll listen to you when you talk about prayer and fasting and discipleship and miracles and things like that. But then there's this other part of my life, this whole other world. And God doesn't have anything to say about that. I want to find the experts. So who went to the school? Who learned all the information? They're the best person. So if they need a psychiatrist or a psychologist for... counseling. Who's got the most number of advanced degrees? Obviously, the smartest person must be the person that could help me. But they don't even think about the fact that God actually has something to say about all of life. There's no divide, a spiritual and a sexual life. All of life is God's life, and He has something to say about all of life. And while a person with a PhD in psychology knows a lot of things that I don't know, the Bible talks about people who profess to be wise, but they're actually fools. So he may be the most knowledgeable person in our nation in a particular field, but the Bible might look at him as a fool because his presuppositions, his starting point, are anti-God and anti-biblical. And I would want to be teaching people on a regular basis that God's word has something to say about all of life. It's not just a spiritual book. It applies to everything. And I would want people, whatever field they're in, to start thinking about how we can influence that particular field through biblical truth and biblical principles. So the secular person who says, I'm not going to listen to you about psychology, you're an idiot, this guy's a PhD, I'm not going to even bother to argue with him. Fine. But let's talk about the fact that Jesus died for your sins and the fact that you're resisting him. Then when I get him saved, now I'm going to start to teach him. Actually, remember that argument you had about, let me explain to you that actually God has something to say about all of life. And while I might not know all the ins and outs of all the studies and all the research that they know, I have some basic underlying presuppositions that are true, and therefore I may be more effective in helping you than a guy with all those advanced degrees. Arthur, what's your thought about that?
Yeah, I agree.
He's a rascal, isn't he? I know he's thinking, I'm never going to ask a question again. Okay, let's take a break. Come back. Oh, you got a question, thought, comment? No? Yeah.
The person he's talking about is a gay.
Okay. Yeah. Let's come back at 15:45 and see if what we can do in this last session.